on Flashpoints, two former high-level CIA analysts speak out against the genocide in Palestine.
The CIA-Mossad Israeli intelligence relationship was very close, and it has become more open and closer as the years have gone on.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Bush returned today from his sweep through the Middle East and his so-called historic visit to Israel and Palestine in the name of peace. But many close observers of the situation in Palestine believe that Bush's visit, along with the Annapolis talks, has been a cover for expanded Israeli violence against Palestinians. Just in the last several days, dozens have been killed and wounded, and those on the ground suspect that the weaponry included special anti-personnel shells that spray civilians with thousands of nails called fleshettes that shred human flesh upon contact. Joining us to talk about this new expanded war against Palestinians are two former officials of the Central Intelligence Agency. Bill Christensen served as a national intelligence officer and a CIA official, and Kathleen Christensen is a former CIA analyst who has worked on Middle East issues for some 30 years. Kathleen is also the author of Perceptions of Palestine and The Wounds of Dispossession. I want to thank both of you for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity.
Well, it's good to have you with us, and I know that the both of you spent a month in the region in November, so that'll give you some insights I'm sure that we can all use. But let's just start with your overview of the Bush trip and the real politics behind it. Maybe I'll start with you, Kathleen.
I think your analysis is exactly right, that this gave gave Israel a green light for more violence, more armed violence, and more violence in the form of theft of more Palestinian land, more settlement building, and so on. And the amazing thing is that the Israelis have been conducting this so blatantly, almost as if it were like a finger in the eye of Bush. You know, just a few days before Bush arrived in Jerusalem last week, the Israelis announced the building of 300, actually one report said 300, others have said up to 1,000 new housing units in a settlement right inside the city limits of Jerusalem, Har Hamah, right at a time when Condoleezza Rice is running around saying, oh, we don't think that there should be any settlement expansion in East Jerusalem. And Olmert says, you know, continues to argue publicly with Rice and with Bush. Bush seems so oblivious to what's going on that I'm not even sure he's aware of the problem. Rice obviously is, and is powerless and sort of disinclined to do anything about it. But it really is incredible, and the violence in Gaza and in Jenin and Nablus. There have been raids into these West Bank cities. Since Annapolis, something like 110 Palestinians have been killed since the Annapolis summit, which was November 27th, which is a lot of Palestinians in 6 or 7 weeks. No Israelis have been killed, so it's really appalling.
And when you say that, it's hard to believe, given the attention that Bush was given in terms of his historic moves towards peace and talking about pressure on both sides. Bill Christensen, you want to take a hit at the real politics?
One other point that you need to keep in mind is that Olmert himself has political problems holding his own coalition government together. And I think something that must be going constantly through his mind is he has got to show force on every occasion to keep all of the other parties in his coalition in line. And I think that's one of the things that is happening now. It doesn't change anything that either you or Kathy have mentioned earlier, but what it means is he himself is not a totally free agent. He wants to stay in power, and he will do the things that are necessary to keep his minimum coalition together. But you can be sure he and Bush talked about all of this between them, and probably Bush agreed to whatever it is that Olmert wishes to do now.
To give him a free hand.
I think you probably both found it a bit of an eye-popping statement when Bush said it's up to the Palestinians to recognize the 1 point whatever million Israelis and forgot in Israel and forgot that a whole bunch of Palestinians live in what's called Israel now.
Yeah, to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. Yeah, this is appalling because, of course, there are 1 point, whatever it is, 2-3 million Palestinians, as you said, living in Israel as citizens, as very second-class, maybe third-class citizens. And if Israel, of course, Israel has all along called itself a Jewish state, and that's what it is, in effect. But asking the Palestinians in the West Bank, Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, to recognize Israel as a Jewish state is asking Abbas to undermine the rights of his fellow Palestinians who happen to be Israeli citizens, to say nothing of the Palestinian refugees who are in camps in Lebanon and Jordan and so on.
Olmert must be riding pretty high right now. He knows that he has Bush in line. I suspect he also knows he has most of the Democratic as well as the Republican Party in the United States in line also. There is either no one or only a tiny number of members of either party, influential members of either of the two major political parties in the U.S., who will stand up and oppose anything that Olmert wants to do.
All right. Let me talk to both of you about the real politics in terms of the region. Both of you have extensive careers with the Central Intelligence Agency and in government and great experience with this part of the world. We know that there's a huge Central Intelligence Agency. I don't know if it's the largest station in the world, but it's close in the region. What are the real politics? Why are there so many CIA officials? Why is there such a big station? What role, how is U.S. politics being integrated into Israeli politics? Or if it's the tail wagging the dog, what is Israel doing? What is this about?
You know, it is to some extent the tail wagging the dog. We have in this country an incredibly strong Israel lobby. All you need do is read the recent book by Drs. Mearsheimer and Walt to see that, even though, of course, most of the supporters of Israel have tried to disown the book. It is, in my opinion, and I think in Kathy's, a very fine book that everyone should read. The Israel lobby is powerful. It has always been powerful. And there are precious few members of the U.S. Congress or high-level officials in the U.S. administration who are willing to stand up to anything that the Israel lobby in this country wants the Congress or the administration to say yes to. I think we all simply have to realize that.
You know, on your question about the CIA, it has come to the point these days that there is almost no difference between the U.S. and Israel and U.S. policymakers and Israeli policymakers on the Israel-Palestine question, at least, and probably on broader questions as well. Even back in our day, we left the CIA ages ago, a quarter century ago, but even then, the CIA-Mossad Israeli intelligence relationship was very close and very closely held, even inside the CIA. And it has become more open and closer as the years have gone on. You know, even during the peace process, George Tenet was out there helping organize the Israeli security forces. And I'm sure the closeness and the extent of this relationship has just grown and grown, particularly nowadays with the Bush administration, when the neocons, who are the Bush policymakers, are themselves so very close to Israel.
If you think back over the last 220 or so years history of the United States of America under its present constitution, I think you will find it very difficult to say anything about any other alliance that the U.S. has had with any other country ever that has been as close and as much of a partnership as the present alliance between the United States and Israel. I personally feel there has never been a partnership between the United States and another country that has been as close as this one. There have been many countries that the U.S. over the years has quite strongly dominated. You can say that there have been close relationship with Great Britain during World War II, of course, but based almost wholly on U.S. domination. This, you know, it's quite common for people to say, well, you know, Israel's really 51st state. No, it is not the 51st state. It is more powerful than any single state in the United States in terms of its influence on U.S. foreign policy in any area that affects Israel at least, and on any subject that the United States, that the government of Israel and the Israel lobby wants to exercise its influence, they, in combination, the Israeli government and the Israel lobby in the United States, can count on, I don't know how many, but something well over 300 members of the House of Representatives, and unquestionably something over 70
probably over 90
the Senate. This is a partnership, much more than the relationship of any individual state ever has or ever could have with the federal government.
It is interesting that we now have a convicted felon in the name of Elliot Abrams, who is the point man, an Iran-Contra figure and a criminal from that era, who is the point man. And what I remember about Elliot Abrams is that this was the guy who went throughout Central America and talked about covered up massacres. Thousands of people being massacred, and he made excuses for the massacres. So one could only imagine that his policy for the Palestinians is really nothing short of an ethnic cleanse. How would you respond to that?
I'm delighted to hear that somebody recognizes this. You know, he operates very much behind the scenes. Not too many people notice. The people say that Condoleezza Rice is so influential with Bush, and she's trying for a political to get the to find a political horizon for the Israelis and the Palestinians, and she's running Middle East policy. I don't think that's true at all. I think it is Elliot Abrams who's running the policy. And the people say that the neocons have lost influence. Well, a lot of them are out of office, but Elliot Abrams is still in office, and he is a neocon par excellence. You know, he wrote a book in the mid-90s in which he just fell all over himself expressing his loyalty and on behalf of all Jews in America, as if he were their spokesman, talked about how important Israel is and how supremely important Israel is to all Jews, and there's a particular bond with Israel and so on. He is an Israeli partisan par excellence, and he's working very closely with the Israeli government on nitty gritty things like the root of the wall, how to change the make little adjustments in the root of this huge concrete separation wall that the Israelis are building inside the West Bank, and he works very closely with Olmert. He's out there. We've heard from several people every few weeks working on policy. He's also trying to stir things up in Lebanon. He is a real danger and a real criminal.
It's hard to imagine that in this, the flashpoint in the world, you've got somebody who is a convicted, pardoned felon as a high-level official in our national security. I'm trying to think of another example where somebody goes from felon to the person calling the shots in one of the most crucial parts of the world.
I know. It's incredible.
It's very hard to find anybody, isn't it?
I do have one, if I could stick a few words in here, one slightly hopeful thing on my mind. This and I, coming out of the Bush trip and other recent events, I think it may, and maybe I'm being too optimistic here, but I'm beginning to think that the situation on the ground is so blatantly horrible, and Bush is so blatantly being led around by the nose by Israel and Israel's friends in the U.S. like Elliot Abrams, that people, even in the mainstream, so-called mainstream press, are beginning to notice. Even CNN, there was a lot of commentary last week when Bush was in Jerusalem and Ramallah highly skeptical about how he was there to see, or why he should be shown the misery that he was creating. CNN correspondent Ben Wiedemann, who's been speaks Arabic and has been there for quite some number of years, even issued a commentary about how he would like to take Bush around to show him the checkpoints and the horrible situation in Gaza and so on. Now, when CNN starts showing that kind of skepticism about Bush and being that honest in its reporting about what's going on, that is a real coup.
But Bush was joking about not being stopped at the checkpoints. I mean, he was making, that was
appalling.
A big laugh for him and the boys.
It's just appalling. But a lot of commentators are noting that and taking note of it. I mean, writing about it. Chris Hedges, who is has never been any friend of Bush, obviously, wrote a very scathing article just a few days ago about Bush's practically idiocy on the way he's handled this situation. And other organs of the press, some official government papers in Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf, who are the official organs of governments that are very much in the U.S. pocket, have also expressed skepticism about Bush's visit and the absurdity of any hope that any expectation that he's going to produce a real peace agreement. So there is, this is a small scale stuff so far, but some people are beginning to take notice.
Kathy started off her last comment saying this was one hopeful sign, and I agree with that. I'd also like to mention at the same time, in spending the entire month of last November there, and by the way, this was our sixth trip since 2003 to the West Bank, and each of those six trips we spent close to 3 weeks there, sometimes a little more than 3 weeks there, sometimes a little less. But in this past year and during our last trip last November, for the first time we ran into a situation where some of the Palestinians with whom we met and whom we spoke with at length were really depressed, because for the first time really ever in last year, 2007, for the first time, Palestinians began killing Palestinians. I think a number of Palestinians whom we talked with were in fact dispirited, markedly depressed because of that, and among some, not a large number, among some Palestinians, at least a few with whom we talked, I thought, Kathy somewhat less than I thought we detected a somewhat greater mood of defeatism than we had on previous trips in the past 5 years. Now, this is very difficult to measure. It's a highly subjective thing. But I think the whole business of how much stronger this administration under George W. Bush has supported the Israeli leadership and helping the Israeli leadership to do almost anything that leadership wanted to do, combined with the fact that for the first time Palestinians were killing Palestinians, I think we at least need to raise the question of how much the mood among Palestinians has changed and ask the question, is there a significantly greater air of defeatism among Palestinians now than there has been in other recent years? I don't want to push this hard, but it really worries me.
Well, wouldn't you say that notion of Palestinians killing Palestinians, that has been a key aspect of U.S./Israeli policy since the free and fair elections of where Hamas won and Jimmy Carter said it was free and fair? Hasn't it been policy?
Yeah. Absolutely. That is totally correct. But the mood, again, I just want to emphasize, we have to watch this like hawks to see how much the mood has changed.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right that the U.S. has been encouraging, as you know, a divide and conquer sort of thing. The U.S. and Israel, too, have been encouraging Palestinians to fight each other since that election in January, just 2 years ago, January 2006. They did not want the Palestinians to form a unity government between Hamas and Fatah, which they did do briefly early last year. The U.S. didn't want that. Elliot Abrams, our friend Elliot Abrams, after the election 2 years ago, told a group of Palestinian activists and businessmen who were visiting Washington, according to one of the people, we need to launch a hard coup against Hamas. And I think that's exactly what the U.S. Tried to do in June last year, June 2007, when the fighting between Hamas and Fatah really broke out in Gaza. I think the U.S. had been arming Fatah's security forces, are encouraging and arming this guy, Mohammed Dahlan, who was the head of Fatah security in Gaza, and planning, and there's quite extensive evidence, I think, of this, planning a coup against Hamas in Gaza, and Hamas got wind of this and beat them to it and preempted what was to have been a Fatah coup, launched its own coup. Of course, Hamas was the government, so I guess what you can't call what they did a coup. But in any case, they defeated Fatah forces, and Fatah has been pretty much pushed out of Gaza. And Hamas was not gentle in doing this. There was a lot of brutality, and Hamas lost a lot of popularity with Palestinians for the way in which it conducted this this thing. But the whole infighting between among the Palestinians has really been fostered and sort of originated with the United States.
Well, let me jump in right here say that we're speaking with Bill Christensen and also Kathleen Christensen. They are former officials of the Central Intelligence Agency. Kathleen Christensen is the author of several books, including Perceptions of Palestine. And we're talking about the Bush trip. And let me see if we can conclude this way. You guys have been coming and going now for some time and spending a lot of time there. And I'm sure you've seen an incredible breakdown. There's great suffering. There's now hunger. People are facing serious hunger, medical shortages. In Gaza, it's a United Nations flashpoints now, and many people are concerned. It does look like an attempt at a form of ethnic cleansing. I want to let both of you conclude by evaluating the situation and what your concerns are if it doesn't get any better.
The situation in Gaza is just horrible. We couldn't get in to Gaza, although we tried on our last trip, because the Israelis, the Israelis say that they left Gaza and that it's totally in the control of the Palestinians, that they left after the disengagement, so-called disengagement in 2005. Well, they left, they pulled their settlers out, and they pulled permanently based troops out, but they, of course, send soldiers in periodically for little invasions and little incursions, and they control every entry and exit point into and out of Gaza, so that people who need medical care and need to get out of Gaza, either to Egypt or to Israel, which has always given sophisticated military medical care to Palestinians, they can't get out. Something like 70 people have died waiting to get out of Gaza for medical treatment, and the Israelis will not let them out. Cargo trucks carrying produce to be exported and foodstuffs to be imported and other essential goods are stopped at the closure points. There used to be a daily average of, I'm not sure the exact number, but it was in the hundreds, 200-300 truckloads daily of imported goods and exported goods going through these cargo checkpoints on the border of Gaza with Israel. It used to be in the hundreds. It is now, I read just recently, something like 19, an average of 19 a day, which is an average over a long period. Some days there's nothing, many days running, there's nothing in or out of Gaza. So that 80% of Gaza residents, this is 1.5 million people, depend on the UN refugee organization, UNRWA, for their food. And 70% are unemployed. There used to be small factories, and agricultural products were the main the driver of the economy in Gaza. They have whole truckloads of produce rot waiting to get in or out of the checkpoints, and it's just appalling. And fuel, even more important in many ways, fuel imports to run electric power stations, which in turn pump are the only thing that are able to pump water, to run sewage treatment plants. They're running out of spare parts and so on. There's an Israeli historian, a wonderful man, Ilan Pape, who has now left Israel and is teaching in Britain. Who calls this what's happening because of the lack of electricity and the lack of adequate sewage treatment and water pumps to pump purified water and to purify the water. The water is becoming contaminated with sewage. It has for years and years been more and more contaminated with salt water from the Mediterranean because the Israeli settlers depleted much of the aquifers. Because the Israelis are holding up fuel imports, these pumps there's no electricity for an average of about 8 hours a day throughout Gaza. Ilan Pape, this Israeli historian, calls this genocide because when you poison people's water and give them no way to drink water, no way to get medical treatment, it is ethnic cleansing, and it ultimately can result in genocide.
I'd like to add just one point to all those things that Kathy said. Not only is she correct, but in another area there has been an almost equal disaster. This is the lack of support for the Palestinians from European countries who are allies of the United States and whom I would have thought up to a year and a half or 2 years ago would have provided more support for the Palestinians than, in fact, has been the case. And what you have is yet one more example of the immense, incredible power of the United States in terms of influence over the governments of our allies in Western Europe. Those who will not go along with us voluntarily, I think, can fairly easily be bribed and are in some cases. I think European governments are often not reflecting the true views of their own people when they refuse to give the Palestinians any more support than the United States has been willing to give, which is none. It is just appalling that we have all these so supposedly more moderate governments in Western Europe following in lockstep along behind the United States and refusing to give any encouragement to the Palestinians who are being just totally squashed by this combination, by this partnership of the United States and Israel. And over the longer term, I think we in the United States are going to pay for this very heavily.
All right, we're going to have to leave it right there. I want to thank the both of you. We have been speaking with Kathleen and Bill Christensen, officials, former officials of the Central Intelligence Agency, have been watching the situation in Palestine degrade. Kathleen Christensen is also the author of Perceptions of Palestine and the Wounds of Dispossession. I want to thank both of you for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you very much.
Thanks much.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, our technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Look us up on the web at flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.